The Joint Intermediate Force Capabilities Office is responsible for the day-to-day management of the Joint Non-Lethal Weapons Program and serves as the focal point for technical and programmatic guidance of current and projected Joint Non-Lethal Weapons technologies. The office provides programmatic recommendations and facilitates Joint Non-Lethal Weapons requirements by ensuring that funding supports the Joint Non-Lethal Weapons systems that the Department of Defense or combatant commands have identified as needs. The Commandant of the Marine Corps is the executive agent for the Joint Non-Lethal Weapons Program, and as such, its director is a Marine Acquisition Colonel responsible for that organization. Today, I have the pleasure of speaking with the man at the helm, the director of the JIFCO, Colonel Wendell Leinbach. Of course, before we get started, a little truth in advertising. I have known Colonel Leinbach for many years now, and one thing he is not is non-lethal. Colonel Leinbach, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Manny. It's a pleasure to be here with you today.
Well, listen, before we dive deep into all this non-lethal stuff, tell us a little bit about yourself and why you joined the Marine Corps and how you ended up in the acquisition world.
As I'm sure for many people, a pretty interesting question and could be a quite a long discussion. But I suffice to say, I grew up in Baltimore, Maryland, was not from a military family, but I was always interested in, you know, team sports and being part of you know, team environments. And so when I went off to college, I had always thought that I was going to be on the lacrosse team. And when I didn't actually make the lacrosse team, I had a bit of a challenge because I'd always identified being part of something bigger and supporting something else other than just myself. And so one day I was introduced to the Marine Corps recruiter at the University of Delaware, and I was immediately taken with the opportunity. While not from a military family, I've always loved the country and certainly willing and able to support in any way I could. So it just fell all into place, and I never looked back. I've been truly honored to serve as a Marine now for going on 30 years. How I found myself in acquisitions is sort of another interesting story, but suffice to say, it was not initially intentional. It was one of those things that I was a tank platoon commander and was told to go off on my first B billet, and was told one of the billets that was available was in Quantico, Virginia. And I said, okay, what's that? And they said, well, it's at Marine Corps Systems Command. And I said, what's that? And they said, I don't know, but it's in Quantico. And I said, I'll take it. Quantico is not far from Baltimore, and I thought a chance to go home and visit family occasionally wouldn't be too bad. And sure enough, when I got when I was assigned to come to Quantico, I just fell into what was then PM Tanks as a young captain, and was introduced to acquisitions. And there was a phenomenal team there at the time that truly took me under their wing and showed me the nuances of acquisitions and what it means to actually, you know, at that point, we were sustaining equipment. We were sustaining the Marine tank. And I appreciated that there is a whole machine that so few people in the operating forces know about that actually make equipping the force and training the force happen. And it was fascinating to me, the complexities and therefore also the opportunities that you had to influence the Marine Corps in a way behind the scenes that not a lot of people know about, but you know makes a big difference. And that was something I latched on to.
So you went completely from voluntold to completely sold on the idea.
Interestingly enough, yes. And, you know, you fast forward a few years, I went back to the fleet and served as a company commander and things like that. There came a time when, as a tanker, you were going to have to decide what you were going to do with the rest of your career. And after tank company command, you know, the opportunities back then for anything beyond that were very small because there's only two active tank battalions. So you had to make a choice. You know, what were you going to be for the rest of your career if you were going to stay in the Marine Corps, if you weren't going to be able to be a tanker all the time? And I thought to myself, you know, I could go back and be part of that acquisitions machine and really potentially make a big difference for the Marine Corps. But then also I knew that I'd worked in PM Tanks before and really loved that community. So it was a chance to continue to help that community after I was no longer serving in the battalions. And when that thought process went through my mind. I said, yeah, I didn't become a Marine to become an acquisitions guy.
Right,
but
right.
It is an opportunity to continue to serve in a really meaningful way. And I'll go ahead and do that.
Well, listen, I gotta take you back to TBS a little bit and, you know, maybe ask you a hard question. What kind of trouble did you get into at TBS that they made you a tanker? And I ask that because for those who perhaps don't know you, you're not a small man by any standards. And I at 6'6" is what I consider it, because I'm on the 5'5" or 5'6" level. So you're completely a foot above me. So you had to have some issues getting in and out of that tank.
Well, Manny, I think you're trying to squeeze an inch on me. I don't know you're 5'6", but from your perspective, I may look 6'6". I'm actually 6'2". And as far as trouble, I was certainly no angel, but I didn't get in trouble at TBS and they made me be a tanker. Interestingly enough, being a tanker is one of the most demanded, or was one of the most demanded and challenging MOSs to get. And I was lucky enough to be one of two tanker slots selected out of my TBS class back in 93. Something TBS teaches you, it teaches you how to be a lieutenant, teaches you the fundamentals of what it is to be a Marine. And that means to understand infantry and the importance of the infantry. And it also teaches you how miserable it is to walk everywhere. And so I put all that together and an interest in machinery and mechanical things and things that go bang. So tanks became a very obvious choice for me. So I was lucky enough and have cherished being a tanker my entire career. I will tell you, that has not come without a few lumps getting in and out of that vehicle. And I've got some dents in my skull to prove it. But you learn to think small thoughts when you get in the vehicle. And I will tell you, when my first tank crew, my gunner was bigger than me.
Wow.
My loader was over 6 foot tall, and that was one cramped turret.
Well, listen, I got to ask you a second question. You know, Marines are extremely proud of their heritage, lineage. So I have to ask, how do you feel now that tanks are no longer part of the Corps?
Well, as I've already alluded, you know, being a tanker is something that's not easily come by Marine officers in the past. Those that have had a chance to do it truly, truly identify and love that community. And all we've done for the Marine Corps and supporting the Marine infantry since World War II. But, you know, it's one of those things that in spite of all the great things the community has done for the Corps, the senior leadership has identified a need to move on and to build in another direction. So we're doing that. But I will always cherish everything that I've been able to do as a tanker, and have been very proud to see in my career how tanks have supported the infantry so well in both Iraq and Afghanistan in combat during my career. That's something that was something very, very motivating to see.
Well, we could have a very long discussion. I'm sure current world affairs dictate some stuff, but like anything else, we evolve, we modernize, and move on. So I appreciate that feedback from you. I do have to ask you another question, because you talked about, you know, you first came on this when you were a cap. If I'm not mistaken, I think you were in one of the first professional acquisition courses that the Marine Corps had, or when we started making Marine acquisition officers. What was that like for you? What was that group focused on at the time? Do you recall?
That's interesting. That happened in 2004, 2005 timeframe, which is when I just returned to Marine Corps Systems Command for my second tour there.
Okay.
So I served there as a young captain on my first B billet, went off and was a tank company commander. Then I went to Naval Postgraduate School, and from there came back to Systems Command and was a young major, and was told about this opportunity that the Marine Corps was going to legitimize the acquisitions community and make it a formal MOS. I had no idea that there were any plans to do that. And I will tell you, up until that point, you know, the folks that came to Systems Command as majors, post-command majors, a lot of them, that's where they ended their careers. And that was my initial experience. You know, when I came there as a young captain, I was surrounded by senior majors that were all, you know, getting out. You know, they were not being rewarded for their acquisitions expertise. And it was in 2004, 2005 that the Marine Corps finally legitimized the MOS in an effort to make it such that those people that did create, you know, earn and understand the acquisitions expertise were not put out, and that they were kept on because they had those valuable skills. And there I was at that turning point in my career where I was post company command as a tanker. The only other opportunities to be a battalion in, to be a tanker in the future were as battalion commanders. And like I said, there was only two of them. And so I took it sort of as an opportunity for me to make that decision that I was going to now become an expert in something else other than just tanks for the Marine Corps,
right,
and be able to serve in that capacity. And so I applied for the MOS. And I will tell you, though, when you applied for the MOS, you, at that time anyway, had to sign a letter saying that you would no longer be considered for operational billets in your primary MOS. And that was not something I did lightly, but I did it with full knowledge of the opportunity that I may have in the future to help the Marine Corps in a different way. And I have not regretted that. I have had an incredibly full career with regard to the breadth of different, you know, programs and communities within the Marine Corps that I've had an opportunity to serve as different capacities as an acquisitions professional. It's been extremely rewarding.
So let me ask you a little bit about that, because, you know, again, I mean, we've known each other for a few years, so I know you've dabbled in several different programs. Tell us a little bit about some of them and what stands out in your mind. I mean, I don't want to say what was your favorite, but what were some of the challenges and things that you enjoyed over the last several years?
I got to tell you, the thing that I found so rewarding about being in the acquisitions world was an opportunity to see really the whole of government and how it actually works, not only you know, within the larger Marine Corps enterprise, but then because of some of the programs that I just sort of happened into, and I'll highlight a couple of them. One, I was the body armor team leader in the 2004-05-06 time frame over in PM Infantry Combat Equipment. And at that time, body armor was a really big deal in the Marine Corps because there was not enough to go around, and there were production issues and quality control issues that were getting congressional attention. And so I found myself as a young major going with, at the time, Marine Corps Systems Command Commander General Caddo, Brigadier General Caddo, up to Congress and you know, supporting his testimony to senior staffers and other things. And that was fascinating to get to see how that part of the world worked and our government worked. So that was one. Two was one that I will always be proud of, and that's when I got to meet you, Manny, and that was working back at PM AAA, Advanced Amphibious Assault. You and I met when we were still running the EFV program, the Expeditionary Fighting Vehicle.
Just a few years ago.
Yesterday. Yeah, it seems like yesterday, but you and I served together there, and we were there to see the dark days and the end of the EFV, but then out of, you know, sort of the, you know, using the analogy, not to be too pejorative, but the ashes of that program rose the phoenix of what became the ACV at the time, ACV 1.1. And that was one of those key times where I can tell you your lessons to me and the importance of communications and messaging rang so true. And that was, you know, here we were at the crux of a, you know, a equipping crisis is a strong word, but a very important equipping decision had to be made because the amphibious nature was a service defining capability for the Marine Corps. And here we had just canceled one thing, and we had to decide where we were going to go in the future. And I'm going to vastly simplify this to say there were a bunch of options that had to be analyzed when the EFV went away. And one of them was to replace the Amtrak with a track that has tracks in it with a wheeled vehicle. And it was no small feat to get the Amtrak community within the Marine Corps to be able to embrace a wheeled vehicle as something that could possibly fulfill their mission. It was only through very deliberate and conscious communications with that community and the broader Marine Corps did we make that even a possible solution. And fast forward to today, and we're beyond IOC. And I'm incredibly proud of the things that you taught me that I put into effect and that have resulted in an actual capability in the hands of Marines.
I appreciate the compliments, but I think it just goes to the nature of who we are, our love for the Corps, and the importance of really telling our story and getting people to understand it every step along the way. It's important to communicate what we're doing and getting passionate, diehard Amtrakers to adjust their vision and their way of thinking to something new, although challenging, but it just goes to the heart of who we are. We're passionate individuals and extremely proud of our heritage. But I got to tell you, over the last couple of years, it's been a great example to see how we've made that transition and that migration and to see the capability now in the hands of Marines. So thanks so much for bringing that up. I appreciate those words.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
Enough reminiscing here. I got to dabble into joint non-lethal. So when I think about joint non-lethal, I think of, rubber bullets and things that are designed to, cause panic, concern, but not necessarily cause death mayhem. So what is joint non-lethal? Tell us what's in your world.
Yeah, so you really cut to the chase right there in that very brief statement. When I left PM AAA, the Marine Corps decided I was, at Milestone C, it was time for me to go do something else. For whatever, the way the stars and moons aligned, the billet that was open was the Joint Non-Lethal Weapons Directorate at the time, that is now the JIFCO. Mm-hmm. And so I was sent over there, and I thought exactly what you just said, and that is non-lethal weapons. Okay. The beginning and end of my knowledge of non-lethal weapons was rubber bullets, batons, tear gas, tasers.
Right.
And I figured, okay, I'll just go over there and work on that for a couple of years and, retire. What I didn't know is that there is this tremendous capability set that is completely unknown, that exists in the, sort of the warehouse of potential non-lethal capabilities. And it all has been residing in this little building on Quantico called now the JIFCO, and not only the entire Marine Corps, but the entire DOD remains largely unaware of it. And it's because of what you just said. It's people hear non-lethal weapons and they assume, and therefore they don't try to hear anymore. And what I realized when I walked in the door there and was introduced to the rest of these technologies, this light bulb went off in my head, because as you said, I'm not non-lethal. That's not my base. My base is tank main gun, put it through the front door, and then run over the building. I got
right,
it.
Right.
You know, I walked in there and I realized there's some capabilities here that are relevant to this entire DOD and to all of the communities in the DOD, not just the MPs and the force protection community, where most people assume non-lethal weapons stuff resides. And I said, we got to find a way to talk about this in a different way. Because when your name is non-lethal weapons in the Marine Corps, or certainly these days when the entire DOD is focused on enhancing the lethality of the force at every turn, you got a message.
Well, yeah, one of the Commandant's prime objectives in Force Design 2030 is, enhancing our lethality, making the
exactly.
Marine more lethal.
Well, it's interesting you should say that, because while that's in force design, you know what else is in force design? A whole bunch of descriptors about how we need to be more proficient in competing in gray zone and competing right. below the level of armed conflict. And unfortunately, what happens is, and this is not pejorative, this is just the way we are. Marines read the paragraph about lethality and they're like, got it. I know what I'm going to do, and they step off smartly. And they don't read the rest of the document. Or if they do, it's all background because they heard what they wanted to hear, which was, I know how to do lethality. The boss said, do that. I'm stepping off. If you read the rest of the document and you appreciate the nuances of how we are going to have to be able to exist inside this competitive space below the level of armed conflict in order to even be able to provide that lethality when and if the time is necessary, if you don't appreciate that, you don't invest in these other capabilities that are critical enablers for that mission space. And that's where the Marine Corps has been. And that's where the entire DOD has been for over the past 15 years. If you look at the investment in what we call non-lethal weapon intermediate force capabilities, which is, you know, the non-lethal weapons tools, that the amount of money being spent across the DOD is infinitesimal and falling. When I realized that that trend line was, you know, asymptotically approaching zero and had no inclination of coming out of there, I knew we had to talk about it in a different way. And that's why we came up with this concept of intermediate force capabilities that is everything between presence and lethality. And if you ask the military, Marine, even, you know, Marine infantrymen, hey, do you ever do missions around the world where your day-to-day requirements are between presence and lethality and you don't actually kill somebody as part of the plan? That's most of what we do. We're out there, we're doing humanitarian assistance, disaster relief, training operations, or just, you know, existing in an environment below the level of armed conflict. And when you're out there, you have to interact with local populations, and we more and more will have to interact with an adversary that is not pleased with our presence and is going to try to push back against us, but do it below the level of armed conflict. Right. And how are we going to effectively exist in that paradigm if all the tools we have are lethal? Because if every tool in your tool bag is a hammer, then eventually every problem becomes a nail. And there's a lot of problems that that we face across the joint force, but certainly as we contemplate force design and what stand-in forces are going to have to do as part of EABO, they're going to have to interact in a challenging environment, and they need tools other than just lethality.
That's a great perspective. I think if you ask most Marines will tell you, I mean, they're trained killers, but killing is the last thing on their mind.
Well, and certainly killing somebody they didn't want to.
Correct.
You know, every unit that served in Iraq and Afghanistan, unfortunately, was either part of or right nearby and aware of unfortunate circumstance where there was a vehicle or an unknown approaching a convoy or the perimeter of a base. And they did everything they could to try to communicate and turn them around. But eventually they had to elevate and try to take out, say, an engine block. And how often does that end up with an engine block with lethal force, you know, putting a bullet into it? And so often that ended up with tragic consequences that nobody intended. Nobody wants to be a Marine that kills a civilian. So
a lot of what you do, obviously, in a joint domain, what are your interactions with the operating forces? And do you focus on their feedback, or is it a constant education process from your perspective?
It's both, and a great question. We, you know, the JFCO is a little organization right there in the middle of the base at Quantico, but it is a joint office, and we do have service members from all the services to include the Coast Guard. We interact with all of the services, and as the director of the JFCO, I regularly travel to senior headquarters across the DOD. I briefed last week down at Army Future Forces Command in Fort Eustis, Virginia, and not too long ago I was up at Coast Guard headquarters up in DC, you know, speaking to their senior leadership about the technologies we're working on and coordinating with them to define requirements and to highlight the opportunities that exist with non-lethal weapon intermediate force capabilities to support all those joint forces. And it's not only them, it's also all of our partners and allies. I reach out regularly through NATO. We work extremely closely with NATO. We are currently staffing an intermediate force capabilities concept document through Allied Command Transformation down in Norfolk, Virginia. just the end of next week, I'm traveling to Brussels, Belgium, and I'm going to be briefing the head of the American military delegation to NATO on the concept, all in a furtherance of highlighting these capabilities and their utility for our partners and allies in pushing back against malign activities by our adversaries below the level of armed conflict, and then also to encourage the use of these tools even in high-intensity combat situations where you're going to have to interact with a local population that you don't want to harm, and there will always be critical infrastructure that we don't want to destroy for either our own reasons or because we don't want to alienate the population we're there to support. And these intermediate force capabilities are tools that enable that.
Well, it's interesting you say that. And you mentioned the Coast Guard and, you know, doing a lot of things below the level of conflict. So I got to ask the question. Obviously, you interact at the DOD level, but I would assume some of this has applications to, you know, police, other civil agencies that are focused on law and order. Is that something you interact with on a regular basis as well, too? Or?
Absolutely. No, absolutely. Great point, Manny. We have regular outreach with the Department of Homeland Security, not only through the Coast Guard connection, through State Department. We work with State and have coordinated with them for years on opportunities to integrate our capabilities into embassy design and to provide the Marine detachments to support the embassies around the world. And then absolutely, we coordinate with many three-letter agencies with regard to technology development, you know, FBI one, but certainly Customs and Border Patrol, well aware of the technology that we work with. And I've been up to their headquarters in Harpers Ferry, West Virginia, and visited them there. That was a fantastic experience. And then even to the point of the Secret Service and also Pentagon Police Force. And we've coordinated with them on technology insertion and potential future opportunities of some really novel technologies that are out there that are game-changing opportunities.
So I got to ask you, what's the average week like for you? I mean, do you know what hat you're putting on or what uniform you're putting on? Or
not so much week to week. I'd say month to month. The focus area for me is a lot of outreach. You know, my team at the GIFCO does a whole bunch of things, not only technology development, but they do curriculum development to support service schools around the country where we have intermediate force capabilities, elective classes at command and staff colleges. And then I have folks that are regularly working at the joint staff and OSD level with regard to policy insertion, making sure that strategy at that level is addressed. So, for example, I was just up yesterday briefing with the joint staff on an opportunity to get some decision papers in front of the JROC on highlighting the need for a deeper appreciation across the DOD on intermediate force non-lethal weapon capability sets. So it is sometimes dizzying the number of hats that I throw on any given day and move in another direction. But I can assure you it's not boring. I've been with the GIFCO now since 2018, so going on 4 years. I'm planning on staying for at least one extra year and will be there until the fall of 2023 to help them continue this transition of the concept discussion away from just talking about non-lethal weapons, which has been limiting to the conversation, to intermediate capabilities that has really helped us engage across the entire force.
So it's interesting to note, we talked to program managers here, and you know, obviously the focus 9 times out of 10 is cost, schedule, and performance, making sure that, you know, whatever capability I'm fielding is, you know, doing what it's supposed to be doing what the requirement needs it to do, but also affordable and sticking to that budget. So it kind of leads me to the next point. You do a lot of things, but none of that would be possible without the support from Congress. So do you spend some time interacting on the Hill in your current position?
Great question. So the answer is I have, but I am not currently. I will say that, you know, when I first came to the GIFCO, one of my early engagements was actually on the Hill and going and speaking to a representative personally. We traditionally, going back to the very beginning of the program, and it was established in 1996 by that year's NDAA, out of a, you know, congressional concern with the reduction of civilian casualties on the battlefield, we have had significant congressional support. recently, I have not spent as much time on the Hill. I liken that for a couple of reasons, not the least of which is COVID has really made it challenging to get on the Hill. But Congress has been extremely busy with some very weighty issues, you know, over the last couple of years that right. unfortunately has not allowed a lot of, you know, what we feel is really important to break squelch at their level. So, you know, I do look forward potentially to get up there again and try to continue that dialogue when things are a little bit more settled.
How about industry? Obviously, you rely on, you know, evolving technologies and whatnot. What's your engagement with industry? Do you spend time looking at capabilities or peeking around the corner to see what's coming down the pike?
Well, absolutely. Well, so the JFCO is an S&T, a science and technology lab. And now when I say lab, we don't physically have a laboratory at Quantico, but we support S&T efforts and we engage labs. Well, there's only two S&T entities within the Marine Corps. One is the Marine Corps Warfighting Lab and one is the JFCO. And so that, by its very nature, requires us to stay dialed in with industry and also academia to understand what are the, you know, the emerging opportunities and technologies. The technology base that we are really dialed into within the JFCO is the directed energy world. And that is the technology that is an absolute game changer that most of the DOD and certainly the Marine Corps is unaware of. And by directed energy, I'm talking about millimeter waves and microwave energy used in counter personnel and counter material mission spaces that, you know, it absolutely changes the way you can affect an environment around you without, you know, the negative connotations of firing rubber bullets or using tasers or throwing tear gas, because directed energy is silent and invisible in the millimeter and the microwave forms. And so to get to your question about industry, we, for example, had our technical team was out briefing in the directed energy symposium, which is a community of industry and government individuals that are specifically focused in that market space. And we were a significant portion of the briefings that were being provided to that group. And in a lot of ways, we've been driving some of the companies such as Raytheon and other big companies in research and development efforts, not driving them necessarily with their own funds, but through our coordination with DARPA and our own investments to get them to do some really cutting edge efforts with regard to miniaturization of the components that can make these directed energy systems much smaller and more energy efficient in the future. They will put them in the form factors that will enable us to integrate them into, you know, tactical vehicles and hopefully one day, you know, down to individual size equipment.
That's fascinating. I mean, that's really cutting edge technology, and I kind of envy what you're doing out there. I got to ask you, I know you've you mentioned this briefly, you'll be sticking around a little bit longer. I know you were recently selected to remain there for at least another year or so. What are some of your goals? I mean, you it sounds like you've already accomplished a lot of things. Are there things you're looking to complete before you change uniforms there?
Yes. I got to tell you, you know, part of what we're doing at the JFCO right now is not only changing the way we communicate across the DOD, but in order to do that in an effective way, we've actually embarked on a deliberate change, what we call change management process within the JFCO, to include an organizational restructuring. And anybody in the DOD that has ever tried to do that, or in the government agency has tried to do a restructure of an organization, I understand why they may have decided not to try. Because it is just what it is. And the process is always challenging, not only because of the human dynamic, and people are always, you know, reticent to change. And that's part of, you know, leadership and just, you know, bringing
not easy to move along. Not easy to move those brick walls.
Right. Not easy to move those brick walls. But then, you know, there's the reality, you know, you don't have to like it. It is what it is. The, you know, the human relation, you know, the HR rules and regulations within the DOD are just time consuming. And I'm not going to rail against it. I'm just going to, you know, acknowledge it. And so we've been working on this for a couple of years. COVID didn't help, but I'm really looking forward to getting that organizational structure in place before I leave. While I'm finishing that up, we're well on the way. We know what we want to do. We just got to get it put in place. Continuing that dialogue at the very senior levels within the DOD, but then also the joint staff and other entities with our partners and allies, in hopes that we will actually see an uptick in investment in these capabilities before I step out the door. That would be really rewarding.
Well, that's awesome. I wish you all the best of luck with that. I know you've got the driving force behind you. But I got to ask you, I know we're kind of running short on time, but I got to ask you one challenging question here. I've asked you a couple. I'll ask you one more. What makes Colonel Linebach tick? It's complicated, I know.
Yeah,
listen,
well,
for those that don't know you, I mean, you're a great family man, a great father, phenomenal Marine. So you surround yourself with some fantastic individuals. But what makes you get up and tick every day?
Well, you've been very complimentary with what you
said.
And
it's not your golf game, by the way.
No, it's not my golf game.
So it's not that.
No, I haven't played golf in I can't tell you how many years. You know, without sounding too campy or cheesy, I got to tell you, every day I love being a Marine. And when I wake up in the morning and I think, wouldn't it be nice to hit the snooze button? I always think, I'm supporting the Marines and I'm supporting the DOD. And that's, you know, that is what I'm here to do. And I put the feet on the floor and get up and move. It's as you said, it's more than that. It's all the things in life that we cherish. And so at the end of the day, having a bourbon doesn't hurt. So it helps keep everything, keeps the sanity at an even keel too. And so all that aside, I will tell you, and I'll throw the compliment back at you. The other thing that makes me tick is, you know, the people I work with and have worked with throughout my career have always inspired me. And people like you that care so much, and the Marines that I've worked with that care so much, to include, you know, Master Sergeant B that you alluded to at the very beginning of our conversation.
Yeah.
You know, it's, you know, never wanting to let those people down. And so that's something that makes it really easy to get up and move in the day. And I got to tell you, we talk about the fact that I'm going to be retiring here probably at 31 years in about 18 months or so. There's a bit of trepidation that comes with that, and the fact that I'm going to have to grow up and get a real job. So
I was just going to say, your wife's going to kick you out of the house. And
yeah, there's no way I'm going to get to work on that golf game. So I don't know what I'm going to do when I have to grow up.
Well, listen, I appreciate those comments. It's probably a little too early for the bourbon, so we'll save that for a little bit later, and we'll have to have one long distance since we're trying this via phone this time. So listen, Colonel Linebach, it's been a great, insightful conversation. Thank you for your patience and making this interview happen. But before we let you go, there's a little thing here on the show we like to do. It's called our lightning round. So I'm going to ask you a couple more questions. You ready?
All right. Quick answers.
All right. I won't put you on the clock, but what's your favorite duty station?
Monterey, California.
Ah, great.
That's easy.
Great choice. What's a TV show, a book, a movie, or a podcast you'd recommend?
Well, other than this one, of course.
I appreciate that.
Yeah. A slam dunk is Kelly's Heroes. Great tanker show. Movie. Clint Eastwood, Telly Savalas, Donald Sutherland. Everybody's got to see it at least 10 times.
Well, listen, if you weren't doing this now, what would you be doing? If you weren't a Marine, what would you be out there doing?
Oh, that's a great question. I'd probably be doing 10 to 20.
Well, as long as you weren't one of the guys who had an option, it was either the Corps or jail, you'd be all right.
It depends who you ask. Some of them would say there's, some of them would never believe you there was any other alternative.
Hey, listen, and the last one, and this is a doozy. If you could have any superpower, what would it be?
Well, as an acquisitions nerd, I'd say the ability to award a contract within 2 days. And if it was a Marvel contract, I'll go with mind reading.
Oh, there you go. Hey, listen, I don't want to take up any more of your time, but I do want to say a great thank you for taking the time to joining us and enlightening us a little bit on the world of joint non-lethal. And it's not as non-lethal as we'd like to think. It's a phenomenal capability in the right hands and the right forces to ensure we do the things we need to do. So with that said, appreciate your time and look forward to having that drink.
Yeah.
All right.
Thank you, Manny. It's been a pleasure.
Semper Fi, my friend.
Semper Fi.
Hoorah.
Hoorah.
Well, this concludes another episode of Equipping the Corps. I hope you've enjoyed our conversation today. If so, please take a couple minutes, leave us a review, subscribe, tell your friends about us. Till next time, Manny Pacheco signing off.